welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. Fraud, folks. That means you don't owe it. It is now or never. I kind of go into the details every once in a while. But as you've been hearing me say, this can't happen unless the people demand their law be complied to. You've been blessed with a system that constrains government at all levels. Technically, the only government that has not been formally constrained is your county. You need to constrain it, because guess who's taking advantage of that? The federal government and the state governments. You need to start using petitions demanding that your county commissioners, your county legislature, actually convenes a committee regarding constitutional compliance. There are all sorts of reasons for this, and we're going to end up publishing probably the original bylaws for Stevens County, as well as all of the facts. Why are we doing this? Because going in, the intent was to do this right. We'll see what happens out of Stevens County, because though Wes McCart initiated this to do this right, what we're going to find out in the near future is whether the remaining commissioners, which is Commissioner Young, Commissioner Burroughs, and Commissioner Stobart, because Stobart replaced Wes McCart. You know, I laugh at the electorate. I laugh at the voters because, oh, this guy's bad. We don't like he's not doing things for us. You know, he's not giving us stuff. And this is a conservative county. They claim to be conservative, but they're not conservative with, you know, the things that they want. They want what they want. But they got rid of probably the most constitutional commissioner that recognized and took action and convinced the fellow Burroughs and Young to do the resolution. So to be clear, we're going to see how this goes. Because right now, the one commissioner that actually is trying to fight this is Stobart. Because it's not what he wants to do. He's actually come right out and said, hey, I don't want to do this. Because, anyway, I'll dive into that later. What we do have on Thursday, because I just want to give you a glimpse ahead, instead of doing some content, we actually have a interview with Bill Cole. He is the founder of Peace Through Strength Institute. And so I kind of brought him on so he could kind of give you his background, why he started getting into this. Because here's a person that was motivated to stand up and do something. Now, whether you like it, whether you disagree, I don't care. Here's somebody that stood up and used their own money, own time, to stand up to do something. Boy, you know, folks, what it would do, the way it would buoy my spirit if you started standing up and demanding compliance of the Constitution. And unfortunately, that just doesn't happen. It's not happening enough. And this has to be the thing. This has to go viral among us. We have to make this viral. You know, how many people have seen those stupid videos, whether it's a cat, or whether it's some North or South Korean singing and dancing, whatever. I mean, how many dumb videos have you inflicted yourself with because it went viral? That's not demure, right? I mean, even that went viral. So what we have to do is we the people, have to demand compliance. This is why we are continually going through the content about, it's all about learning, praying, and acting, okay? And it's all about compliance. Now, we just are wrapping up. I just literally have a little line, one sentence left of the act of, now let me see here, I believe this was the act of 1785. Let me get into it. The 1785 act, starting it off again, yes. An ordinance for ascertaining the mode of disposing the lands in the Western Territory passed May 20th, 1785. So what we've got here is we've got this act that I'm wrapping up, and then we're going to get into the next act, which is kind of a resolution of May 1786. This is what they're saying it is, and even though there's a conflict because they say it's 1786, 1785, and then they actually get into the language, and it says the Land Act of May 18, 1796. Now, let's be clear here. 1785 was just a couple of years before the convention. The convention occurred, and at that point, I think Continental Congress really decided to, okay, they just passed the Northwest Ordinance, which was an agreement of the individual states with the people of the territory, as well as there was some involvement of Continental Congress. Nevertheless, Continental Congress, after just passing that, just received the Constitution. They said, you know what? This is big. This thing is huge. This thing takes over everything. It gives, it creates a new government, and it gives that government all the necessary powers to actually admit states into the Union and so forth, and will supersede everything the Continental Congress had done, other than it will continue the obligations and treaties with foreign states and nations. Now, all that being said, in 1789, when the Constitution formed, because it was ratified in 1788, in 1789, it formed the new government. And so the best way they were able to do that was going up to New York, because they thought, okay, well, we need a venue that will have the buildings necessary to occupy for the House of Representatives, the President, as well as the Senate and the Judiciary. So they started setting up the government for 2 years up in New York. Then they moved down to Pennsylvania, or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and started setting up government there. Now, we've kind of covered over the past few years what kind of happens in doing this. But one of the things we have been covering specifically, and we've just been going through the congressional record and identifying in the very first year, the very first, how many months? Almost 12 months that we covered of the House record, there was no passing, no consensus, and no direction of what they were going to do regarding the disposal of land within the territories, because in the Constitution they have that authority to be able to do that in the territories. Once that state becomes a state, Congress cannot access, sell, or do anything with that land. The state takes full cognizance and ownership. So in the very first session so far, as I've gone through this, there has been no bill, no act, nothing to basically allow the federal government to execute anything other than what has kind of been happening under the Articles of Confederation. Now, whether they pulled them in or not, I don't think they did. I think they just, because 9 times out of 10, it's kind of defeatist to stop everything, just to allow those things that are happening, let those things continue, and we'll fix them and pull them in and do them right under the Constitution. And I believe that's exactly what happened. So now they're going into this new, like I said, this new act. But let me close out the old act. So this is the final statement that most all of these acts have. Done by the United States, assembled the 20th day of May, in the year of our Lord. How dare they say that? Ooh, that seems like establishing a religion. I mean, the left or the evil Antichrist people, they're so sensitive. Anyway, in the year of our Lord, 1785, and of our sovereignty and independence, the ninth. Okay? Sovereignty and independence, the ninth. And I have no idea why they closed it that way. Richard H. Lee, President, Charles Thompson, Secretary. Now, the next is a resolution of May 1786, they say. But actually, I say it's not. Because everything else shows that this is all done by act. But we'll see when... there's some problems with the documents that I have. They've just kind of consolidated them, but they've mixed up the dates. Anyway, whereas the ordinance for ascertaining the mode of disposing lands in the Western Territory directs that the geographer and surveyor shall pay the utmost attention to the variation of the magnetic needle and shall run and note all lines by the true meridian, certifying with every plat what was the variation at the times of running the lines thereon noted, which direction will greatly delay the survey of said territory. Resolved, that the above recited clause in the said ordinance be, and the same hereby is replaced. Okay, and this basically is the Land Act of May 1796. So they've got the document that's actually conflicting with what they've put up in their summations or summaries. Anyway, an act providing for the sale of lands of the United States in the territory northwest of the River Ohio and above the mouth of the Kentucky River. Section 1. Be it enacted that a surveyor, now what we're going to do is when we go through the congressional record, because I'm still plugging through this, folks. I told you, it takes a lot of time. That first year took me a good day to go through, pull it, and then, you know, kind of consolidate it into PDFs. But what we're going to end up doing, what I'm going to end up doing is creating a constitutional records page so that you can pull all 100 pages up in blocks. Now, I'm not pulling in, I've said this before, I'm not pulling in the Senate, because the Senate is just a summation. It doesn't get into the details, and summations is just like your professor editorializing his opinion and feelings on what happened in, you know, in American history or what have you. But anyway, be it enacted that the Survey General shall be appointed, whose duty it shall be to engage a sufficient number of skilled surveyors as his deputies, whom he shall cause without delay to survey and mark the unascertained outlines of the lands lying northwest of the Ohio River and above the mouth of the River Kentucky, in which the titles of the Indian tribes have been extinguished, and to divide the same in the manner hereafter directed. He shall have authority to frame regulations and instructions for the government of his deputies to administer the necessary oaths upon their appointment and remove them for negligence or misconduct in office. Section 2. Be it further enacted that the part of the said lands which has not been already conveyed by letters, patents, or divided in pursuance of an ordinance in Congress passed on the 20th of May 1785, or which has not been heretofore and during the present session of Congress, may not have been appropriated for satisfying military land bounties. So again, the majority of what they're doing is they're bringing in the veterans into this territory, giving them the land so that they can work it and so forth. And you know, if you think about it, some of these guys are probably wounded or what have you, so you know, it would be their families. Anyway, nevertheless, and for the purposes shall be divided by north and south lines run according to the true meridian, and by others crossing them at right angles so as to form townships of 6 miles square, unless where the line of the late Indian purchase or of tracts of land hereto surveyed or patented or the course of navigable rivers may render it impracticable. And then this rule shall be departed from no further than such particular circumstances may require. The corner of the townships shall be marked with progressive numbers from the beginning. Each distance of a mile between the said corners shall be also distinctly marked with marks different from those of the corners. One half of said township, taking them alternately, shall be subdivided into sections, containing as nearly as may be 640 acres, each by running through the same, each way parallel lines at the end of every 2 miles, and by marking a corner on each of the said lines at the end of every mile. You know, this is not easy going through this type of stuff. Anyway, the sections shall be numbered respectively, beginning with the number 1 in the northeast section and proceeding west and east alternately through the township with progressive numbers till the 36th is completed. And it shall be the duty of the deputy surveyors to cause to be marked on a tree near each corner made as aforesaid and within the section the number of such sections, and over it the number of townships within such section may be. And the said deputies shall carefully note in their respective field books the names of the corners, trees marked, and the numbers so made. Now, you got to think, wow, this was very well wooded out in that area at that point in time. Now, when you go into this area today, there's not a lot of woods out there, is there? So the thing that they would put it on the closest tree to that corner means that there were probably a lot of opportunities. I don't think that they would have said, you know, you would say, use the trees as you're surveying the desert, right? You'd have to come up with something different. But anyway, the fractional parts of the township shall be divided into sections in manner aforesaid, and the fractions of the section shall be annexed to and sold with the adjacent entire sections. All lines shall be plainly marked upon trees and measured with chains containing 2 perches of 16 feet and 1/2 each, subdivided into 25 equal lengths, and the chain shall be adjusted to a standard to be kept for that purpose. Every surveyor shall note in his field book the true situations of all mines, salt licks, salt springs, and mill seats, which shall come to his knowledge, all water courses over which the line he runs and shall pass, and also the quality of the lands. These field books should be returned to the surveyor general, who shall therefrom cause a description of the whole land survey to be made out and transmitted to the officers who may superintend the sales. He shall also cause a fair plat to be made of the townships and fractional parts of the townships contained in the said lands, describing the subdivisions thereof and the marks of the corners. This plat shall be recorded in books to be kept for that purpose. A copy thereof shall be kept open at the Surveyor General's office for public information, and other copies sent to the place of sale and to the Secretary of the Treasury. Now, the one thing that seems obvious is by going through and identifying what's on each parcel, what's on each land, and taking detailed note of the salt licks, those types of things, and the usability. What they're basically doing is they're laying out what would be either an intrinsic or an actual value to each of these parcels of land. In so doing, it may give the buyer, well, I kind of want this one, because that way they can have a salt lick, that way they can have a mine or what have you. Keep in mind, nowhere in the Constitution has the federal government been granted the authority to own or possess any land or claim soil rights, mineral rights, within the states. The only thing they can do is they can erect forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings in pursuance to their duties, their stewardships, responsibilities of maintaining a militia, protecting the Union. And they can only do that at the agreement by the state legislatures and paying the state legislatures whatever the fair cost is for the fort that they have to have, or the fort that they want, the building that they need, the arsenal, and so forth. So let me get into Section 3. Be it further enacted that a salt spring lying upon a creek which empties into the Scioto River on the east side, together with as many continuous sections as shall be equal to one township, and every other salt spring which may be discovered together with the section of 1 mile, which includes it, and also four sections at the center of the township containing each 1 mile square, shall be reserved for the future disposal of the United States. So right here, they're making this assertion that they are going to make a disposal of this prior to this land. They have to do this before the land becomes a state. But it doesn't matter. They can't withhold that. They, when a state joins the Union, they have no authority in the Constitution to deny the state the territory and those things within that state, that's theirs. They are sovereigns. So even if they sold this, even if, you know, they sold it to people, what have you, the state basically takes, and whoever owns that, whatever happens to that, when it becomes a state, it becomes folded into that state. So if it's a business that's now, you know, processing the land for, you know, soaps or whatever they come out of these salt licks and these mines, then that becomes an industry that is then managed and falls under the cognizance of that state. So to close out Section 3, but there shall be no reservations except for salt springs and fractional townships where the fraction is less than 3/4 of a township. Now, Section 4, let's see how long this is, because we've got basically 2 minutes. Yeah, it's kind of long. So I'll basically put this off until we come back from the break. Again, I'm trying to emphasize, folks, we're going through this because the federal government has the ability, constitutional authority, to dispose of lands while that territory is a territory. Once they form and frame a state, they have no ability to not surrender all the land within the boundaries of that state to that state. They have no ability to not surrender that land. In other words, they cannot admit a state into the Union and say, you don't have control over this part of this land, over this part of this land. What they have to do is when that state becomes a state, any forts, arsenals, what have you, they will then have to say, okay, we have these forts, we'd like to keep them, so we're hoping that the state legislature, as soon as you form it, will maintain it until you form, and if you agree, then we will pay you so much for having these properties in supporting you. But to do it any other way, because the Constitution mandates that the state legislature agree that they possess that land within their state, and that they pay for it. And there's no reason why the state can't say, hey, hold on here, we're going to lease this to you, so you're going to pay us every year for this, because we don't believe that in 100 years we're going to have problems with Indians. We don't believe that the British are going to be breathing down our necks, and the French, and all of these problems that we may have today, that this is going to be a perpetual thing for all time and eternity. Therefore, this is one of the reasons why most military installations were leased. I know that almost all of the military bases in California are leases, where they're leasing the land, and they're leasing it at a song. I mean, like a dollar an acre. I think U.S. Marine Corps El Toro, Air Station El Toro, was, I believe, a dollar an acre, or maybe a dollar for the entire base, because, you know, the federal government needed it, and they started paying the state, and the states, you know, they can be as greedy as they want, or they can be as cooperative as they want. I think they all tried to be cooperative. But anyway, We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into section 4, 5, and however many others. I just see 4 and 5 right now, but anyway, we'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get into Section 4. Be it further enacted that whenever 7 ranges of townships shall have been surveyed below the Great Miami or between the Scioto River and the Ohio Company's purchase, because apparently that Ohio Company purchase was probably a big purchase, or between the southern boundary of the Connecticut claims and the ranges already laid off, beginning upon the Ohio River and extending westward, and thus the plats thereof made and transmitted in conformity to the provisions of this act, the said sections of 640 acres, excluding those thereby reserved, shall be offered for a sale at public venue under the direction of the governor or secretary of the Western Territory and the surveyor general, some of which as lie below the Great Miami shall be sold at Cincinnati, those of them which lie between the Scioto and the Ohio Company's purchase at Pittsburgh, and those between the Connecticut claim and the 7 ranges at Pittsburgh, and the townships remaining undivided shall be offered in sale in the same manner at the seat of government of the United States under the direction of the Secretary of the Treasury in tracts of 1/4 of township lying at the corners thereof, excluding the 4 central sections and the other reservations before mentioned, provided always that no part of the lands directed by this act be offered for sale shall be sold for less than $2 per acre. Now remember, in the congressional record, they were talking about $1.25. So this being 1796, just a few years later, obviously the price has gone up to $2. Be it further enacted, this is Section 5, that the Secretary of the Treasury, after receiving the aforesaid plats, shall forthwith give notice in 1 newspaper in each of the United States and of the territories west and south of the River Ohio of the time of the sale, which shall in no case be less than 2 months from the date of the notice. In other words, everybody in the colonies, or everybody in these new independent states under the Constitution, are going to receive notice that there's this land, and in 2 months they're going to have this place where you can go and buy land for $2 an acre. Now, it's going to come along, it's going to come to you in these large parcels. So in other words, you're going to have to buy 100 some odd acres or something like that, which means it's going to cost you a few hundred dollars, which maybe a lot of money. To me, there's no doubt that most people wouldn't have that. let me see here. Let me just kind of take it off from be it further enacted on Section 5, that the Secretary of the Treasury, after receiving the aforesaid plats, shall forthwith give notice in 1 newspaper in each of the United States and of the territories northwest and south of the River Ohio of the time of the sale, which shall in no case be less than 2 months from the date of the notice. And the sale at the different places shall commence within less than 1 month of each other. And when the governor of the Western Territory or secretary of the Treasury shall find it necessary to adjourn or suspend the sale under their direction, respectively, for more than 3 days at any one time, notice shall be given in the public newspaper of such suppression, and at which time the sales will recommence. Who knows? Could be for harvest. Who knows? For whatever reason. Okay, Section 6. Be it further enacted that immediately after the passing of this act, the Secretary of the Treasury shall, in the manner herein before directed, advertise for sale the lands remaining unsold in the 7 ranges of townships which were surveyed in pursuance of the Ordinance of Congress passed the 20th of May, 1785, including the lands drawn for the Army by the late Secretary of War. Now, that job function right there, the late Secretary of War, that right there was a position that was created under the Constitution, right? The War Department and the Secretary of War. Originally, that was General Knox. And anyway, and also those heretofore sold, but not paid for, the townships, which by the said ordinance are directed to be sold entire, shall be offered for sale in public venue in Philadelphia under the direction of the Secretary of the Treasury in quarter townships, reserving the 4 center sections according to the directions of this act. The townships, which by the said ordinance are directed to be sold in sections, shall be offered for sale at public venue in Pittsburgh under the direction of the governor or secretary of the Western Territory, and such person as the president may specially appoint for that purpose, by sections of 1 mile each, reserving the 4 center sections as aforesaid. And all fractional townships shall also be sold in sections at Pittsburgh in the manner and under the regulations provided by this act for the sale of fractional townships, provided always that nothing in this act shall authorize the sale of those lots which have heretofore reserved in the townships already sold. Now, one thing I want to point out is that even though the federal government was doing this, and they became a land-selling machine, in so doing, I see that the states would probably, as the new states like, let me see here, which did we have? We had Ohio, actually was the first state to join the union, so they, being nice with everybody, probably said, yeah, you can go ahead and continue doing things. We won't keep you from that because you're doing a good job. Because the federal government became a well-oiled land-selling machine. They were making money at it. This was a great way of putting money into the Treasury. In addition, they were also, with the fact that Ohio came into the Union, that could now lay apportionment taxes upon Ohio. I don't believe, at that point in time, the apportionment taxes were probably too high, just due to the fact that they were obtaining revenues from, you know, these unconstitutional products from the bank that Hamilton was creating. They were putting impost on goods coming in and so forth. So I don't believe, and I don't remember hearing much from any of the states, because they complained in the ratification debates that those apportionment taxes, the taxes that they were going to levy upon the states, were going to be so bad. The only taxes that we seem to have gotten pushback, to go, oh, this is terrible, was the whiskey tax. The excise taxes, they didn't like those. So just a thought to consider how things started going, where just because the states didn't force the federal government to comply to the Constitution. That gave, I think, the predilection, and or I think those people in Congress, they started doing things because they were being allowed to do things, and that's the way it was done. And then they started, as new people, well, that's how it's done. And nobody started questioning whether they had the authority. Where in the first 5, 10, 15 years, other than the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, where were the states actually pushing back? Now, I know at one point in time, under Jefferson's presidency, there was a big pushback from the eastern states, or I should say the northeastern states, the New England states, because they had a convention to literally consider getting out of the Union, leaving the Union, because the problem was they had to have, you know, as Madison stated in the report, there had to be a willful and a meaningful violation of the Constitution. And just because Jefferson exercised these tariffs, which are within his rights, they didn't like that. So the way, I think they were trying to figure out how they could secede, and then when all of a sudden things started working out, where things weren't as bad as what they thought they were, and things kind of turned around, you know, they lost interest in seceding. Anyway, Section 7, be it further enacted that the highest bidder for any tract of land sold by virtue of this act shall deposit at the same time of sale 1/20th part of the amount of the purchase money. Oh, so you didn't have to pay in full. You had to pay at least 20%, 1/20th, right? Okay, 20%. And be it forfeited if the monetary of the sum bid, including the said 20th part, is not paid within 30 days to the Treasury of the United States or to such person as may be appointed by the President of the United States to attend to the places of sale for that purpose, and upon payment of a moiety, they're calling it a moiety, of the purchase money, within 30 days, the purchaser shall have 1 year's credit for the residue and shall receive the Secretary of the Treasury or the Governor of the Western Territory, as case may be, a certificate describing the land sold, the sum paid on the account, and the balance remaining due. The time when such balance becomes payable, and that the whole land sold, will be forfeited if the said balance is not paid. So they're basically giving the buyers a great deal. You got 1 year to pay this off. Now, today we have, you know, such expensive lands that, you know, you get a 30-year mortgage. But at this point in time, it seemed like the federal government was giving them a 1 year allowance. I do not see this as a mortgage. Why? Because it didn't seem like they were being hit with interest. They were only, the remaining balance was due at the end of the year. But that if it shall be duly discharged, the purchaser or his assignee or other legal representative shall be entitled to a patent for the said lands. Now, this right here, and I got to go to the beginning of this whole sentence, so I'm highlighting this one sentence, the entitled to a patent for the said lands. In other words, a deed, the title, right? And on payment of the said balance, because you hear people today say you have to buy the, you have to get the patent for your land. And that's only the vernacular that they used back in those days for the transfer or for the whole ownership to be transferred to the new owner. They were using the term a patent. So whether they use the term deed, title, or what have you, unless, and see, this is where the government and corporations get tricky. They change the names. So I think this is one of the reasons why the state nationals will tell you you've got to go buy your patent. Now, here's the thing. Does the federal government have the ability to keep and possess your land? do the corporations and banks, in the idea of you buying land, have the ability to not actually let you have that land that you pay for? Because somewhere in some word speak, they've been allowed to actually be the possessors and controllers of land. No. There's no authority between the government, corporations, and, you know, banks and so forth to be able to do this kind of a Ponzi scheme or this kind of fraudulent scheme to perpetrate upon the American people. They don't have the authority. There's no amendment to the Constitution to allow these kinds of shenanigans. So, it's one thing for you to have, because you don't have the money, you take a mortgage out and you're paying interest. The question is, how much of those contracts are legitimate? For the most part, I would think most of them are. Most of them are, because it's a financial contract that says, hey, you know, we want to help you get this land. We want you to be the owner of this land, but we're going to finance you, and you got to pay, you know, us this certain interest, 3%, whatever. And over a 30-year period, it comes out that you've actually paid twice for that land or what have you, and that's almost like usury, but those are different issues. The reality is the government does not have the ability to change and say, yeah, you can have the patent or you can have a title, which means something different, but we're going to tell you it doesn't. The deceit and everything else, they don't even have the ability to reclassify land so that they can keep it. That's not in the Constitution. Keep in mind, folks, that when that state became a state, that state then had that authority. Does your state, in your state constitution, have the ability to not give you your land that you paid for, that they own it all and you're just renters and subjects? This is why, let me dive into, you know, what I put into the latest article I'm writing. As Thomas Jefferson stated, ignorance of the law is no excuse, right? I mean, you've heard this before, right? And so let me get to the full pretext of this. This is the quote from Thomas Jefferson. Ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country. If it were, the laws would lose their effect because it can always be pretended. What he's basically saying, folks, is if you're ignorant of the law, they can get away with pretending. They can't, actually, because in our Constitution, and Thomas Jefferson, I believe, said this. Let me look at the citation on this. When did Thomas Jefferson say this? In 1787, prior to the Constitution. At that point in time, under the Articles of Confederation, and more specifically, the Constitution of Virginia, they had general powers. So they could pretend law. But in our Constitution Republic, folks, focus on this, folks. You need to focus on what I'm saying. In the context of our Constitution Republics, at the federal level, the federal government cannot pretend law that is not in pursuance to the Constitution. It is not law. In the states, they cannot pretend law. They cannot make law that is not in pursuance to the powers granted within the state constitution. Ergo, understanding the few powers that have been delegated will help you understand what laws you can actually deal with. Because when a law comes along from the federal government regarding kidnapping across state boundaries, that's illegal. Well, hold on here. That's not in the Constitution. If you understand those few enumerated objects, the laws must be in pursuant to those things. How hard is it to know whether something is of the law or not when it comes to the federal government? Pretty simple. But when the federal government comes along and creates laws and regulations and hands them down to the states, such as labor laws, such as health care laws, such as you fill in the blanks, and they're not enumerated within the Constitution, and your states are executing these laws because they're not within your state constitution. This is the pretending that Thomas Jefferson is talking about. You, today, folks, we don't necessarily need to know all of the laws. We only need to know what has been enumerated, because any law that is not within those objects are not law. Suffice it to say, if you understand the enumerations, you are ahead of the game. Now, in a general contract, everywhere else in the world, where the constitutions and the power delegated, because this was brought up in the ratification debates, it was even pointed out in Virginia, how Virginia had general powers. Then, if they created a law, you needed to be apprised by that. That's why ignorance of the law is no excuse, because you have to know that they created that law. Ah, but if they don't have the authority to create that law, then now it becomes really simple. Right? Now you don't have to worry about family law that's underneath the umbrella of the federal. Everything that's considered family law, that is considered federal laws, is not law. Why? Because there's no family, there's no ability or power within the federal government to create regulations on families, children, child protective services, those things. And they're the ones that have created this evil apparatus throughout the United States, where they've been basically weaponizing your states to get into the knickers of the families in your states and to start forcing the payment of child. All these things maybe seem good. Oh, they're deadbeat dads are paying their way. The federal government has no authority to do this, folks. They don't. And actually, your state court doesn't have any authority over family law either. Most states don't have. They have not enumerated that law to, or those types of powers to your state government. Folks, they're pretending the crap out of you. And they're basically killing us with all these pretentious laws, or these pretended laws, I should say. They're being very pretentious. Yes, they are. And the fact is, folks, understanding, this is why, understanding the Constitution and the simplicity in America. It's not like we really have to go, hold on. They've got this law. Does that law violate the Bill of Rights? Because that's how it is in England. You have to actually say, well, this law kind of steps over, and it becomes a struggle to fight to where you think it's violating your rights. And if the good lawyers and the good judges, we don't see it that way, then you're screwed. It's that simple. But in America, you can't get screwed over, folks. You cannot be taken advantage of. The object must be enumerated. But yet, they're getting away with doing these things because nobody's been challenging them. This goes back to what I was saying. In the beginning, when states and the federal government started doing these things, and the states just kind of went along. They created these acts, and the states just went along because, hey, it sounds like we're going to benefit. Why not? The only time that there was an actual pushback that really stood out was the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. Why do you think we tell you how critical those documents are? Because the father of the Constitution gave us the breadcrumb trail of what we need to do today to take back our government. That's all. It's really that simple. We don't need to convene a convention. We don't need to go to court. We don't need, to get the party, to make sure that what the party wants, those people the party wants elected. No, we need to make sure that the party is supporting full compliance to the Constitution. You need to take the party back. The party can't solve this, but they're a part of the problem. The courts can't solve this and won't solve this, and they're a part of the problem. But we don't join the courts. We don't face the courts. We face our legislatures and tell them, get those courts in line with the law. with the supreme law of the land. The courts and the Bar Association, all unconstitutionally formed, and that's a really broad brush. So let me be clear here. When the lawyers and the Bar Association formed, that was unconstitutionally done. It violates the nobility clause. And what they did was they, on their own, started assuming and forming, or I should say transforming, our Republican form of government into a judiciary form of government. Prior to that, the parties, as they started recognizing that they didn't want a bunch of third parties to keep coming and annihilating them, the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, formed an alliance in creating primaries, and they took, from that point forward, they monopolized access to public office unconstitutionally. So in other words, they control who can get into office now. You either have to be a Republican or a Democrat. And the fact that they put barriers on your ability to run in office as an independent is a violation, especially for the House of Representatives and the Senate, because the Constitution stipulates what the requirements are. If the states levy additional requirements, like you have to pay money, no, then that right there violates your right for becoming a senator to represent that state, or representative to represent the people in where you live. They can't create barriers to federal offices. They're getting away with it with the state, and nobody blinked when they started applying these types of standards, because the golden standard is embossed in the Constitution. You have to be a citizen, that 25 years of age, and a citizen of 7 years to be a representative. That's it. You don't have to pay money. You don't have to get a bunch of signatures. You only need to be a citizen 7 years and 25 years of age to be a representative. And the states have gotten away with saying, well, you know, if you want to get your name on the ballot, because that costs us money. So what? That's the cost of business for government. What really should piss you off, folks, is that the parties are actually running primaries at your expense. There's no constitutional allowance for the primaries for federal elections. None. So these things we get into in these articles, why counties matter most, will explain to you how the corporation, or I should say how the courts have assumed a judiciary form of government, how the parties have assumed a party form of government, and corporations and banks have done the same thing. This is how we have completely obscured the reality of our Republican form of government. And they don't want you to understand these things. You see these people, you know, giving you these epiphanies, you know, on Facebook, media, and these memes and so forth, like they're really giving you the truth. When they're challenging things, but they're not really exposing the truth. It's only with the facts that we can see the truth. Folks, this is why you have to take that stand. You have to at least stand up and start holding all of every public servant accountable, or run for office and say, hold me accountable to my oath of office. It's all about full compliance of that Constitution. That's why we start every show the way we do. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.